I'm Tracy Sable. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, arrival in Indonesia. The Holy Father begins the longest trip of his pontificate. Pro-abortion push. Vice President Harris and her running mate begin a bus tour to defend abortion. Hostages and heartbreak.
Tove, and thank God right now in front of all of you for giving me this magnificent present of my Hirsch.
Reaction after the news that six people being held by Hamas have been murdered. Plus, small business, big honor. What Fortune magazine is saying about a Catholic media company. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Well, thank you for being with us on the feast of Pope St. Gregory the Great. Our top story tonight, fresh protests break out in Israel following the deaths of more hostages at the hands of Hamas. The six victims include an Israeli-American.
Early Sunday morning in Israel, the parents of Hirsch Goldberg Polin received the devastating news that they would never see their son again after he was murdered by Hamas.
The U.S. State Department says we grieve for all of them and we demand justice for all of them. Protesters in Tel Aviv mourned the six victims again today. Some blame Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for not doing more to save the hostages. Meanwhile, the U.S. says that it's working on a new ceasefire and hostage deal. And the United Nations Security Council plans to convene tomorrow to discuss the war in the Middle East. Now, the funerals for the six hostages have begun in Jerusalem. Hirsch Goldberg Polin, the 23-year-old Israeli-American, was remembered as a wonderful and caring son. His mother says that she thanks God for the all-too-brief time they had together.
One thing I keep thinking about is how out of all of the mothers in the whole entire world, God chose to give Hirsch to me. What must I have done in a past life to deserve such a beautiful gift? It must have been glorious.
Rachel Goldberg Polin wore a sticker with 332 on it, the number of days that her son was in captivity. She traveled the world seeking support for the hostages. And last year, she met with Pope Francis. And earlier this summer, she and her husband, John, spoke at the Democratic National Convention. On Capitol Hill, lawmakers reacted swiftly to the killing of the hostages by Hamas. They want the killers found and an end to the war. But some Israeli experts say the U.S. does not understand the motivations of Iran and Hamas. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales joins us with that story. Eric.
Well, good evening, Tracy. Yes, the latest killings of the six hostages in Gaza is unifying lawmakers against Iran, which we know is sponsoring Hamas and other terrorist groups. Bottom line, experts say Iran is responsible, and U.S. lawmakers say that Tehran must pay the price.
Hamas could care less about the hostages or the Palestinians. And if you want the hostages home, which we all do, you have to increase the cost to Iran. Iran is the great Satan here. Hamas is the junior partner.
We're not putting boots on the ground in these tunnels under Gaza, so it is a very difficult situation in terms of our own ability to rescue these hostages. But I really sincerely believe the administration is doing everything possible.
House Speaker Mike Johnson also released a statement saying in part, quote, "The brutal murder of innocent hostages by Hamas shows the entire world the depravity of this terrorist regime and reminds us that Israel must not merely be allowed to defend itself, but supported in its effort to completely eradicate the threat of future attacks by Hamas." A former Israeli lieutenant colonel who spent 25 years as an intelligence officer says President Biden needs to stop following former President Obama's foreign relation beliefs.
Barack Obama is still controlling many things. Mm-hmm. And he still believes that Iran could be convinced to behave like a normal state. He doesn't get it. Neither he nor Biden.
He adds after the October 7th attack, the U.S. stopped Israel from going after Iran's nuclear installations. And on October 7th, Hamas jumped the gun on what would have been a multi-front coordinated attack and prevented a much larger strike. But that doesn't mean Iran won't attack again.
They might postpone it for a while until Israel falls asleep on guard, as it did on October 7th. And they will assume it could be now, it could be in a year or 10 years. Nuclear weapons in the hands of these people is very dangerous, very dangerous, because at any given moment they can decide that Allah gives them the order to use it.
As Israel continues to plunge into protests, Pope Francis continues to call for the immediate ceasefire in the region. In his September 1st Angelus prayer, the Holy Father once again turned his thoughts to the conflict in the area and for negotiations to continue and for the release of hostages and the release and the relief, that is, for the people of Gaza. At the Capitol, Eric Rosales, EWTN. News Nightly.
All right, for more, let's bring in Stephen Cook with the Council on Foreign Relations. Stephen, good to be with you again. Just a heartbreaking situation with the six hostages found dead in Gaza, killed by Hamas. During a press conference, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu asked for forgiveness for not bringing them back home alive. Stephen, I know it's hard to know what is inside of anyone's head, let alone a terrorist, but why do you think Hamas militants killed these six hostages while in the midst of ongoing negotiations?
Well, I think it's clear that Hamas is not really interested in a ceasefire. Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar has over and over again denied an agreement that his negotiators are working towards. There are text messages and messages from him to negotiators in Doha and Qatar saying, I don't see a reason why we should negotiate. We're winning this conflict. The Hamas also made it very clear that they will kill hostages if the Israel Defense Forces undertake rescue operations. And the IDF was in close proximity to these hostages. And they were subsequently murdered in cold blood as the IDF moved in.
Yeah. And Netanyahu also said that Hamas will pay a very heavy price for the killing of the hostages and that he will not yield to pressure to abandon his demand for troops to remain along the Gaza-Egypt border and the Philadelphia corridor. Stephen, tell us why this particular strip of land is so important to the Israelis and why it appears to be a sticking point in reaching a deal.
Well, the Philadelphia corridor is the place where, as you point out, Gaza and Egypt meet. And it is also underneath that border in which there are multiple tunnel networks in which smugglers have resupplied Hamas. There are some allegations that Egyptian intelligence officers and border commanders have turned a blind eye or even profited from this smuggling. And the Israelis believe that while they are on the Philadelphia corridor, that smuggling cannot resume. They fear that if they leave, the smuggling will resume and they'll have this problem all over again. Hamas rejects this, and quite frankly, our strategic ally Egypt rejects this argument and says that Israel must leave from the Philadelphia corridor, that the Israelis are in violation of diplomatic agreements with Egypt dating back to 2005. That handed the corridor over to the Palestinian Authority.
Yeah, in the meantime, it seems like things are reaching a boiling point in Israel as thousands of people took to the streets protesting over the killings of the hostages. I want to get your thoughts on that. And what do you think this signals to Netanyahu?
Well, this is an extraordinarily heartrending moment for Israelis who had been hoping to get back as many of their people alive as possible. They are angry at the government. They believe that there are points at which, had the government demonstrated more flexibility, that hostages would have come home. That is, I think, hope. I think that is faith in what they had been hoping for. But I'm not sure that that coincides with reality and Hamas not really willing to engage in serious negotiations, just as members of the Netanyahu government are not interested in a ceasefire. So I don't believe we're as close to a ceasefire. But nevertheless, Israelis believe that this government is culpable. And that is why Netanyahu, for the first time, took responsibility. But I don't think it's going to have a significant impact on his political standing. His coalition is pretty sturdy with 64 seats in Israel's 120-seat legislature, gives him the majority he needs with some cushion.
Almost out of time here, but quickly. I mean, do you think even at this point that we're at right now, do you think that a ceasefire deal can be reached, Stephen?
Very quickly, no.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. Stephen, great to be with you as always. Thank you for your insights.
Thank you.
All right. Just more than 2 months until Election Day, and as promised, the Harris-Walz campaign launches its pro-abortion bus tour. It begins in what the campaign calls Donald Trump's backyard in Palm Beach, Florida. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports. Owen.
Tracy, the Harris campaign labels its tour Fighting for Reproductive Freedom, end quote. It'll make about 50 stops, starting in the Sunshine State. And that's where voters will soon decide on a ballot measure that, if okayed, would do away with pro-life protections there.
The Harris-Walz campaign rolls out its new pro-abortion bus tour. In Florida, Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar told supporters,
"But do understand, Florida, that this is a national movement. Americans have shown us time and time again that they will not tolerate a country where our daughters have fewer rights than their mothers and grandmothers."
But National Right to Life President Carol Tobias writes, if elected, Harris-Walz will be relentless in trying to make abortion legal in every state for any reason through all 9 months of pregnancy, with our tax dollars paying for it. Adding, even though women supposedly have a choice, they will be pushed to choose death. In the midst of the campaign, President Joe Biden discusses his Investing in America agenda.
The bottom line is thousands of cities and towns all across America are seeing the great American comeback story, whether they're in red states or blue.
And in the White House press briefing room, Director of the Office of Intergovernmental Affairs, Tom Perez.
We have a workforce shortage. We have so much opportunity. We need to make sure that we build the skilled workforce to compete. That's undeniably a challenge. But it's a great challenge to have.
Also, Donald Trump posts on social media he's holding a town hall tomorrow in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. The Republican is investing more advertising dollars there than any other state through Election Day. Vice President Harris is also courting voters there, just yesterday appearing at a rally in Pittsburgh with President Biden.
And she has a backbone like a ramrod. And she has the moral compass of a saint. This woman knows what she's doing.
And a well-known name in Pittsburgh, U.S. Steel. Harris says she's opposed to its planned sale to Japan's Nippon Steel. Donald Trump, also against the acquisition, has said he would block it instantaneously.
Also tonight, Harris and Trump are neck and neck in most national polls. They're now focused on undecided voters in just seven states. And currently, about 7 in 10 voters believe the nation is headed in the wrong direction. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
Okay, thank you, Owen. In Ukraine, officials say more than 50 people are dead following a missile strike on a military training facility. The strikes hit the city of Poltava in one of the deadliest attacks since the war began. This comes following Ukraine's now weeks-long incursion into Russia's Kursk region. Meanwhile, Russian President Vladimir Putin is visiting Mongolia, his first trip to a member nation of the International Criminal Court since it issued an arrest warrant against him. Mongolia says that it will not honor the warrant. Now to France, where local media say one man is in custody following a fire at a 19th century Catholic church. A report in Le Monde says the suspect was known to authorities for committing similar acts in the past. The blaze at the Church of the Immaculate Conception caused the bell tower to collapse. Despite the massive damage, no injuries were reported. At least 13 people are dead after a boat full of migrants rips apart in the English Channel. A coastal town in France is being used as part of a rescue operation. Dozens of people fell into the waters of the busy channel, and around 61 people have been saved. Last week alone, around 2,000 migrants tried to cross the channel. A teacher in Ireland has been arrested for the third time over a transgender pronoun dispute. Enoch Burke was suspended 2 years ago for refusing to use a transgender student's pronouns. He has now been arrested for defying a court order to stay away from the school that dismissed him. The evangelical Christian accuses the court of trampling his religious rights. Sad. We have a lot more still to come here on EWTN News Nightly, including Eyes on Venezuela, analysis of why the U.S. government seized a plane used by Nicolas Maduro. And a New Jersey diocese sues the U.S. government. We have all the details. Welcome back. The The Diocese of Paterson, New Jersey, is suing the U.S. government. The move comes amid fears that some foreign-born priests may be forced to leave the country after a change last year that threatens the ability of people to continue to minister in the United States. The U.S. Church has long had agreements with foreign dioceses to bring in clergy to help deal with a shortage. While the U.S. government seized a plane being used by Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, the Justice Department says the plane is part of violations of sanctions and export control laws. U.S. officials also say the aircraft was purchased illegally through a shell company and smuggled out of the United States. Maduro's socialist government responded, calling the move, quote, piracy. And staying in Venezuela, a judge there issues an arrest warrant for the opposition party's former presidential candidate. The move comes amid a criminal investigation by the socialist government into the contested results of the disputed July election. Maduro was declared the winner, setting off a series of protests. And for more, we turn now to Jason Poblet, president of the Global Liberty Alliance and an expert on South America. Jason, great to have you back on, my friend. A lot to discuss, but first, I want to start off with the seizure of President Maduro's plane by the United States. What does this move signal to you? And do you expect more pressure to be applied to the Maduro regime?
Well, thanks, Tracy. And I think what's going to happen, and I'll put some context on this in a minute, he's just going to go out and buy another plane. I mean, that was a largely, frankly, symbolic move. And just to give your viewers some context, a lot of this immediate tension began back in late July when, for some reason, the Biden-Harris administration and some Republicans agreed to an electoral process in a totalitarian police state, which that's what Venezuela is. So the people with the guns, the people who control the ballot box, the people who control the electoral system agreed to have elections in a place where it's impossible to have free and fair elections. So they're fighting about who won, who didn't win. We know that the government was never going to accept that. So there's been like an escalation, and the sanctions are part of that. And you saw in your piece there introducing the item, you mentioned that the Maduro regime has gone off and now issued arrest warrants for people in the Venezuelan resistance. They're not opposition, and we can talk about that in a minute, the resistance. And that's what I continually see this back and forth with Venezuela and the U.S. and this policy of trying to do something in a place where it really can't happen. So there's a lot more that will come of this. I think Maduro's going to go out and buy another plane. I think that's the least of our concerns right now. There are some big problems there. And look, my family fled a totalitarian police state. I feel for the people of Venezuela because there was a great purge that has happened. The millions of Venezuelans have been expelled or have been forced to leave. Here in the U.S., we're seeing, Tracy, and I'll close with this, the largest crime spike in Venezuelan gangs in quite some time, this transnational crime. And it's impacting us right here. So that's why we need to care. We need to focus on what's happening in the hemisphere and be more proactive about it. But promoting elections in a place like Venezuela, it's not the way to do it.
Yeah, Jason, I also want to talk about, you mentioned the arrest warrant. We talked about that. What more can you tell us about that and also the timing of it? Does this surprise you at all?
No, it doesn't surprise me at all. And I think you will see a lot more of that. They will try and use, the Maduro regime has used Interpol, you know, that international red notice system that alerts other countries of people who are wanted in those countries for alleged crimes. And the Maduro regime has been very adept at using that system. Most of those Interpol red notices are not respected. Interestingly, they are used against people who are here today and who were fleeing that system. So they've been targeted also. What they did in that move, I'm not sure if it was because of the plane, but the timing of it was interesting. In fact, that they announced it. All right, well, you can seize the plane, but guess what? We're going to go off and we're going to sanction and go after the people who ran in those elections in late July for president. That's the election they're all fighting over right now. So I think you're going to see a lot more of that.
Before I let you go, I'm almost out of time here, Jason, but what about the people in Venezuela? I mean, how are they feeling right now since the election happened?
And this is a terrible situation. And that's one of the things as Catholics, by the way, that we need to be mindful when our policymakers push people to do certain things, and we have to be ready to back them up. We knew these elections were not going to work out correctly because the Maduro regime was never going to honor them. In fact, I don't think they were even held correctly. So to encourage people to hit the streets when we know that the crackdowns are coming, and they came, there's that great purge. You know, my family was purged from communist Cuba in the early 1960s. That was a huge purge of people who were Catholics, anti-communists, what have you. That's been happening at a different clip in Venezuela. and we are seeing the persecution happening. So if you were involved in those protests, they targeted you. Social influencers, they were targeted. So they're going through a very difficult time, and we have to pray for the people of Venezuela and pray for the people of Nicaragua or Cuba and other places where you have these type of governments. And America needs to change its policy so it focuses on, for example, getting rid of the Russians, getting rid of the Chinese. We focus on that, we're going to be helping the Venezuelan people. But raising these false hopes about elections, changing the system, that's not one way to help the Venezuelan people.
Yeah, we're going to continue to follow this story, too. Jason, thank you so much for coming on. Always appreciate it. God bless.
God bless. Thanks for having us.
Up next on EWTN News Nightly, a long and challenging trip. Indonesia welcomes the Holy Father on his first stop of his 12-day tour. Trip for the pontificate of Pope Francis is now underway. The Holy Father arrived in Jakarta to begin his 12-day tour of Asia and Oceania. It is the first time a sitting pope has visited the majority Muslim country since 1989. EWTN Vatican journalist Benedict Sidigrin has more.
Buongiorno. Buongiorno a tutti voi.
After a 13-hour flight from Rome, the Holy Father has landed in Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia, kicking off his 45th apostolic journey abroad, the longest of his papacy. He was welcomed at the Nunciature by refugees taken in by the Jesuits, orphans raised by Dominican sisters, and also homeless people, together with elderly, accompanied by the Indonesian community of Sant'Egidio. In the following days, the Pope will have several appointments in the capital as he kicks off his intense 12-day visit in Southeast Asia.
It is actually a diplomatic visit of Pope Francis in order to confirm and to encourage Indonesia to live and to enjoy the long-standing diplomatic relation between the Holy See and Indonesia. And the Catholic Indonesia, being a tiny minority, is very happy, very grateful that Pope, the head of the Catholic Church and all over the world, is coming to Indonesia after 11 years of his pontificate, after visiting more than 60 countries.
Because Indonesia is the country with the world's largest Muslim population, the visit will be particularly important for the smaller Christian communities.
Indonesia is a very particular country, having this composition of religious majority and minorities. For a long time, Indonesia has been entitled the model for peaceful coexistence of religions. Well, the visit of Pope Francis to Indonesia is very significant for the interreligious dialogue, for Indonesia itself, but also for the whole world, I think.
The Pope is scheduled to participate in an interfaith meeting at Jakarta's main mosque, the largest in Southeast Asia and ninth in the world, just across the street from the Cathedral of Our Lady of the Assumption. The Holy Father's visit will culminate in a mass celebrated for the country's Catholics at a Jakarta stadium before flying off to Papua New Guinea on Friday morning. In Rome, Benedict Sidigrin, EWTN News Nightly.
And finally tonight, one Catholic media company has ascended the list of Fortune magazine's best small businesses. Ascension Press is ranked number 8 in the 2024 Fortune Best Small Workplaces. 99% of employees reported that it was a, quote, great place to work. Ascension is best known for its publishing division, a YouTube presence, Father Mike Schmidt's Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year podcast. Ascension CEO says the workplace culture has led to a less than 3% employee turnover rate. Good for them. And we thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Tracy Sable. Good night, and God bless.